comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, ladies and gentlemen, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Talk radio like nowhere else on the planet. It's the show where you matter. We're here because you have a right to know. You know, the KSS, the Kevin Smith Show, is a little bit different from a lot of other shows out there. Not necessarily, I'm not necessarily saying that it's better or I'm just saying it's a little different in several ways. And one of the ways is that we made a decision several years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, pardon me, to be commercial-free, listener supported. And the only way that can happen, of course, is for the listeners to support, and a number of them do. But we need you, and you need the community that we provide. So if you're not a member, consider this. First of all, we're only all it takes to become a member is 23 cents a day. That's it, $6.95 a month. Come on, that's nothing. But what do you get for that? Well, you get access to our community, and our community in the members area is made up of some absolutely wonderful people. Everybody interested in the same sorts of things, but different views on those things. We have forums. We have a chat room. We've got you get your own profile page where you put your information and load up your own picture to it. You have your own photo gallery. You've got where you can load pictures that are important to you. Some people load pictures of UFOs or ghosts or something like that. Some people load pictures, like I did, of my family. Up to you. It's your photo gallery. You also get your own blog. And I go in and read those blogs, and in fact, some of those show up in our free weekly newsletter, the K-Files, and we've got some really good writers in there. You've got a video galaxy where you can go watch videos that we've posted for you. You can you've got a free ebook library where you can download free ebooks, and we have special broadcasts in the members area. We have one coming up this Saturday, as a matter of fact. Had one last Saturday. We got one this Saturday as well. So, members, if you don't know about that, you need to go check your message box. That's another thing you get in the members area. You have your own private message box. Check that, because that's where we send information about upcoming events, special broadcasts, inside info, etc. And I sent one to everyone's message box informing them about this Saturday's upcoming special broadcast. You don't want to miss this. Believe me, you don't want to miss this. And no, it isn't me. Tis not moi. You don't want to miss this film. All right? Now, I'm going to send another one of those out probably on Friday, and that'll take care of all the people who have just become members. And then if you're not a member, you can become one tonight. We want to see you in the community. We'll be back right after this. You're listening to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Paul Kimball. Paul Kimball is a lot of things, but probably known to you as someone who produces television and films. And probably because you're listening to the Kevin Smith Show, you know about his television programs and films having to do with the paranormal and or UFOs. This is his first time to be with us, and I'm especially pleased to have him with us this evening because, Paul, I've seen your film, Best Evidence, Top UFO Sightings, Top 10 UFO Sightings. I've seen it, and in fact have watched it a couple of times, and it's excellent. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Kevin. And it's great to be here from the east coast of Canada, where hockey playoffs have just begun. So,
you know, that's really, really a tough sport. You know, American football can be pretty tough, but hockey, that comparing it to football is warfare.
Yeah, it is a tough sport, but oddly enough, as a Canadian, I've played basketball, baseball, and football, but I'd never played hockey. So sometimes I feel more at home sporting-wise whenever I go down to the United States. But, yeah, and thanks for saying nice things about Best Evidence. Glad you liked it.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's an excellent film, and we're going to talk about it some tonight, as well as Beyond the Evidence. I got a question for you before we get into that. I was looking at your biographical information, and it says you graduated with honors, with a degree in history and political science. You have a law degree, and you're making television shows and films about ghosts and UFOs. How did that happen?
Yeah, it's probably a film script in itself someday. When I graduated from law school in 1992, I articled. I was called to the bar here in Nova Scotia, and I was playing in a rock and roll band at the time because I was young and foolish. And my dad, who was a judge, he was a criminal court judge, sat me down one day and he said, "Son, the law is a jealous mistress. You can either be a lawyer or you can play in a rock and roll band, but you can't do both and do them well." And my dad's idea was that I was going to, of course, choose the law. And I chose the rock. I said, "Dad, you're absolutely right." And then I chose the rock and roll band. So after 5 or 6 years of being in the rock scene up here in Canada, I decided I wasn't going to be the next Paul McCartney. And I was looking around to do something else, and I sort of fell into the film industry. Largely because what I've always wanted to do was tell stories. Whether it was in a courtroom telling stories, or whether it was writing a history paper, whether it was being a musician writing songs, or whether now it's writing and directing and producing films and television. And so, you know, it just seemed to be a natural place to go, and various opportunities came up that allowed me to do that. And so I spent the last 13 years making a wide variety of film and television programming on subjects, including the paranormal, UFOs and ghosts and such. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, things like classical music. And I did 2 seasons of a television series for Bravo on classical music. So it's not all paranormal, mm-hmm. but that seems to be what, you know, I don't do radio shows talking about classical music. So I guess I'm most well known for doing the paranormal stuff.
Well, you know, I would think certainly with this audience you would be, because, you know, that's what we're focused on. So people who are listening to this show would be familiar with that part of your work. Before we jump into talking about these UFO and paranormal films, you said you were a rock musician. I'm curious, what do you play?
I play nothing well. I was a guitarist, and my primary role was as a songwriter. I can't sing worth a lick. I make Bob Dylan sound like Pavarotti. So I played the guitar reasonably poorly, but just well enough to be a rhythm guy. I have good rhythm, and I wrote the songs for the band. So in Halifax in the 1990s, they called it the Seattle of the East. there were a lot of bands that came out of here in the early 1990s that went on to... Sarah McLachlan is originally from Halifax, for instance, mm-hmm. who went on to various levels of stardom. So it was a very vibrant music scene back in the 1990s, and, you know, it was a lot of fun to be a part of that. And it's a part of my life that I look back on quite fondly, in fact, to the point where my old band, which I haven't played with in 16 years, a couple of the guys I haven't even really spoken to in 16 years, not that we're angry at each other, just haven't seen them, we're actually reforming this fall for a reunion gig and to record a new album. So you can always go home again, and that's something that I'm looking forward to doing.
Well, you know, one advantage, and I'm just using your words, you said, you know, you play guitar poorly, but you have good rhythm. One of the advantages of that is you can go for years and come right back to that. You haven't lost anything.
Yeah, it's like riding a bicycle, frankly. And it was really odd because there were a lot of songs I hadn't played. When I left the music industry in 1998, really, I really didn't pick up a guitar for another 5 or 6 years. And I really haven't played at all much over the last decade or so. And so, you know, I picked up a guitar and was kind of trying to remember how the old songs went when we decided we were going to get back together for a reunion gig. And it all came back pretty quickly, and you realize, you know, those kinds of things, whether it's playing music or, frankly, even the knowledge that I learned in law school or in college when I was studying history and political science, you know, you might not have used it for 20 or 25 years, but the human mind has a remarkable capacity to pull things back out of the past and use them again in the present, even though you might not have utilized that knowledge in the last 20 or 25 years.
All right, let's move over to the paranormal and UFO side. You did a TV series about ghosts that aired in Canada and I believe in New Zealand as well, right?
Actually, Best Evidence aired in Canada and New Zealand on TVNZ. The ghost show Ghost Cases aired in Canada, and it's just recently sold, our distributor told us, of all places, in Thailand.
So oh, good.
I hear that I'm about to become very popular in Thailand. But,
well, that's where my home is.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, you'll be able to see me in Thailand then, of all places. Not a country I ever thought that anybody would ever see me on their television. But, yeah, I co-produced, co-wrote, and co-directed a series called Ghost Cases with a fellow named Dale Stevens up here in Nova Scotia. And it was basically 13 episodes shot here in Eastern Canada and in the United Kingdom, in England, where my co-host, Holly Stevens, and I sort of did a Scooby-Doo kind of thing, where you kind of show up where people say, look, our house is haunted, or our school is haunted, or whatever, this place is haunted. And we kind of, make a long story short, played Can You Spend a Night in a Haunted House and Have a Personal Experience? So we had all the technical stuff that people use, like EMF meters and everything, which, frankly, I don't put any real stock in. At the end of the day, I thought it was much more interesting to have a personal journey, to follow these two people, both of whom are skeptical, Ollie and I, and see if they actually have anything happen to them. And mm-hmm. we did, which is what makes it even more interesting to me.
So you sort of went into that, you say you were skeptical, you went into that with the idea that there's nothing to this, right?
No, I wouldn't say that. The thing about skepticism is, and I think it's a term that is tremendously misunderstood and misrepresented. I think most people should be and probably are skeptical. I would use a different term, perhaps call it agnosticism,
mm-hmm.
where you say, I just don't know. There's mm-hmm. something here that's worth looking into. Maybe, maybe not. But most Canadians were centrist by nature. And so we sort of sit in the middle of the road and we say, well, we don't like the extremes on the right wing, and we don't like the extremes on the left wing, and the same thing is true with we don't like the extremes of believers, but we don't like the extremes of disbelievers either. And so I think a lot of the people who parade around in the paranormal field, if you will, who call themselves skeptics, for instance, the people at what used to be known as PSYCOP, now they call themselves the CSI, I guess, mm-hmm. Committee for Scientific Inquiry, they're not really skeptics. What they are disbelievers. And they are the flip side of the true believer coin. And so I try and avoid both of those groups. and say and speak to the vast majority of people who I think find all of these subjects interesting. They're not sure whether UFOs represent aliens from Zeta Reticuli or whether ghosts represent the spirits of people who have died and passed on or whatever they might be. All they know is they find it interesting, mysterious, and they want to learn more about it. And I think that is true skepticism. And so, yeah, when I say we were two skeptics going in, we were very open-minded and very interested in the experiences. We didn't go in and say, this is complete bunk, clearly. Mm-hmm. We said, no, there might be something here. Let's find out. Let's ask questions. And that's the approach that I've always taken.
Well, and really, that's the only fair approach. People who come to any topic with their mind already made up, either positive or negative, either way, you know, there's not a whole lot they're going to learn from that experience because they've already got their mind made up. And you can have your mind closed on the side of I believe, or you can have it closed on the side of I don't believe.
Sure.
And either way, it's a closed mind. And I certainly appreciate the approach that you're describing, and it's the one that I try to take here. You know, I tell people I don't believe anything. I either know it or I don't know it, and I'm comfortable saying I don't know. And yeah. I don't know, of course, means it needs further investigation. Well, what were some of the coolest experiences that you had when you were going into these haunted places?
The coolest experience I had was going in with Holly all the time, because Holly, if anybody, there's an episode of the series up on our company's website that people can watch for free, and, you know, Holly is just a really cool person to hang out with, and it was a pleasure to do the series with her. So that's, I always say that was the coolest part of the show. Having said that, you know, the coolest sort of paranormal experience, there was a church. We didn't go into the church. It was a cemetery in a churchyard surrounding an old 13th century church in England just on the Welsh border. It's not even a town. I wouldn't even call it a community. There's nobody that lives there. But a spot on the map called Shoclack. And that was probably, we had some strange things happen in any number of places that my open-minded skepticism all I could do was shrug and go, I have no idea what that was, but that was weird, and I don't have an answer for that, so that means I have to keep asking questions. In Shoclack, so many things happened that evening and that afternoon that we were there. Holly, we didn't know any of this going in. We would always sort of get briefs about where the location was, obviously, and some of the stories, but we didn't want to get too many details because you don't want a situation where you're, in essence, leading the investigators, if you will, the same way as you might lead a witness on a witness stand. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to experience most of these things fresh. So in Shoclack, there was, among all the things that happened, this one didn't happen to me, but there's a sequence in the episode where you see Holly getting really freaked out, is probably the only, I mean, she's not screaming and raving, she's very controlled and within herself, but it's clear that she's very disturbed, I suppose, is the best way that can, out of sorts, if you will. Mm-hmm. So one of the British investigators we were working with, a very good investigator named Steve Mara from a group called the Unknown Phenomena Investigation Association, walked up to her and said, oh, hello, Holly, you know, what's wrong? Which is the worst British accent you're ever going to hear, the one that I just did. And Holly, you know, basically said, you know, Steve, I just feel like something's happening here. I can't describe it, like there's a presence. And then Dave Stadler, who was the other UPIA member that was with us, another very good investigator, walked up. And as he listened to Holly describe what was happening to her, he just said, at the end, he said, Holly, you have described word for word almost what other people in this exact spot have described happening to them. Now, Holly had no knowledge of that. We checked. It is true. Other people that were there described the same experience, a feeling out of sorts of just weird is the only way I can describe it. Holly doesn't match. I mean, it happened to her, so she had a much better way of describing it. And that was kind of the kickoff, because that happened in the afternoon. From there, we had audio anomalies. Both Holly and I, at different times, and then together, heard what could only be called the sound of horses' hooves on cobblestones. And if anybody has ever heard cobblestone, horses' hooves on cobblestones, or hard dirt roads, if you will, and I have because we have that here in Halifax. You know the sound when you hear it, you know, that kind of clip-clop, clip-clop, clip-clop. Mm-hmm. There was nothing around. This place was so isolated, it's not funny. There were no roads around it other than a dirt road leading in, which was completely empty, and a mud track that went around the church, soaking wet mud track. And we heard this at different times. Again, this was something we were unaware of, but that other people had reported hearing in that same space. And it links back to a funeral cortege that they used to, or funeral procession, I guess is a better way to call it. They used to come down to the church when they would bury people. They'd bring them down in a horse-drawn hearse. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, was that what we were hearing? I don't know. All I know is we were not prepped or primed for it, and both Holly and I separately, and then together as we were talking about it, we both kind of stopped and went, what the, did you hear? Yeah. And I believe Holly might have uttered a profanity, which we had to cut out of the show, because we were just so, you know, kind of just shocked. Those were two of the things. There were many other things that happened that evening that just kind of, the whole experience of being there, it was just an amazing place to be. And we walked away from it thinking, wow, I mean, that's a place I would like to go back to. Of all the places I went to, that is the one place that I, the next time I'm in England, I will make my way up to Manchester, the Cheshire area, and I will go back to Shocklack just to see if any of it happens again.
Did any of the audio anomalies show up on recordings? Were you able to get any of those?
That's the weird thing. Well, that's one of the many weird things. We had audio, audio recorders with us every time we went into a place, and in some occasions, they picked up things that, you know, I'm very skeptical of this audio stuff. A lot of it has to do with the fact that most people, including us, were using the highest tech recording equipment, and there's a lot of ways you can account for things. What I found weird about the Shocklack experience was we didn't pick up anything on camera audio, on the audio recorders we had. None of the audio recording equipment we had picked up any of that stuff. They were sounds that only Holly and I could hear. And I heard them twice, I can guarantee you. And that, you know, Kevin, that's one of the things that I think that actually I brought to the show, because I had a long history of 10 years of making films about mostly UFOs in the paranormal area and commenting on it and stuff, of being skeptical to the point of really annoying a lot of people within the UFO community who would call me a debunker or something. So I think I had built up a fair amount of credibility going in, saying, look, this is not a guy who's going to lie to you. It's not a guy who's going to say something just for ratings, and it's not a guy who's going to fake it. If he tells you it's happening, it actually happened. It doesn't mean that I can offer an explanation. It just means I built up the credibility to say, look, this happened. You probably should believe me. And I the two audio experiences I had, I can't explain. I just know they happened. There is no record of them on any of the audio recording equipment that we had. And I find that actually more compelling than getting a so-called EVP on a tape recorder that you leave on a desk or something that might or might not be somebody saying something.
Mm-hmm. I actually saw a show on television, I won't tell you the name of it, where you could tell they fake the EVP. We have to step away for break, and we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, filmmaker and television producer, Paul Kimball. Paul, as we went to break, I was saying, I'm not going to name the show, but there was I was watching I'll call it a Ghost Hunter show, but it was not the Ghost Hunters. It was not the show by that title. And they played what they purported to be an EVP, and you could tell that it was a human, a live human, whispering near the microphone. And the way you can tell that is that a microphone has its own ambiance. It has its own sound. The sound of my voice would be different with a different microphone. And what you would hear over the radio would be different. It would sound different, still recognizable as me, but it would have a different sound with a different microphone. And EVPs are, they are purported to be electrical interference of a spirit with the device. They don't use a microphone. The microphone wouldn't work for them because no one in the room hears it. It's not an audible sound, and the microphone picks up audible sound. And when this EVP was played on television, you could tell for sure it came through the microphone that we were hearing everyone else's voices on. And from that day till this, I've never watched that show again. So, but I do think that there is an unexplainable phenomenon that we call EVPs. I do think it is real. I do not know where they come from. Do you have a theory on EVPs?
Well, it comes. We had enough of them happen that I divide EVPs. I divide almost everything in this sort of ghost hunting, if you will, or ghost investigation world, into two things. One, they just exist on their own, and those I usually dismiss. They have to have some sort of context to interest me. So, if you pick up an EVP, say, where... Here's a good example. I'll give you an example. We did an episode at a place called McCall's Farm. It's a little farm in an isolated village in southwestern Nova Scotia called Quinnan. Again, out in the middle of nowhere. It seems like I was always getting stuck in places that were out in the middle of nowhere. But the long story short, the basic story was the house was haunted. We had upstairs, and it was a relatively small house, upstairs Holly was with a psychic and they were doing an automatic writing kind of thing. I certainly don't dismiss psychic phenomena, it's not my cup of tea, so Holly got to deal with the psychic whenever we would go do something else. So what I did was I went down in the basement alone. Now, it was a farmhouse, so anyone who's ever been on a farm knows that generally how a farm works. It was more of a root cellar, so you actually had to go outside, walk around the house, and then climb, you know, go down the stairs, these rickety wooden stairs, into what was basically a cellar. It was very cold, the middle of February, so I was down there freezing by myself. The door was closed, and I had a camera on me, and I obviously had a mic. So, anyway, Holly and Kelly, as they're doing this, again, we didn't know this going in. So Holly and Kelly, the psychic upstairs, I can hear them through the floor because it's sort of, you know, one of those houses, and I could hear bits and pieces of what they were saying. So as they're going along, they start talking about, and Kelly starts, the psychic, starts claiming, I'll say claiming, to get impressions, you know, there's a baby in the basement. The spirit or whatever is telling me she would write baby, basement, baby, basement. I didn't know this until later when I saw it on the camera. All I heard was baby and basement. So I said, you know, you can see me in the camera saying, oh, great, you know, they're saying there's a baby in the basement. Well, that's freaky. And then I did hear them say, isn't Paul in the basement? And Holly goes, yeah, Paul's down in the basement. Maybe we should ask the baby to go down and make itself known to Paul. Now, I came across at the end of the series as being not the most intrepid ghost hunter you'll ever find. So, you know, there I am on camera, and I look at the camera and I go, they're saying now that the baby should come visit me. I don't want the baby to come down and visit me right now. I'm perfectly happy being alone in this basement. I don't want a ghost to come down. At that very moment, the door behind me that led to the outside came open, you know, sort of, meow. Now, there was nobody else in that area. The nearest house was quite a ways away. It was late at night. It was freezing cold. I thought it was the crew playing a practical joke on me because they knew I'm a bit of a wuss. So I got up and I said, okay, you know, fine. I walked out. Nobody there, nothing. And as it turns out, all the crew and everybody had been inside. I didn't go back down in the basement. I have to admit, by that point, I was already a little scared. That was just a scary place. And that kind of freaked me out because I knew that door, and the door itself, you had trouble, you kind of had to really sort of give the door a good pull to open it. We had experienced that earlier in the evening when we were doing our initial walkthrough. There was no wind at that particular moment. you know, my skeptical mind went down all the possible explanations. I couldn't account for why that happened. Okay, so that alone, you would say, well, if that just happened alone, maybe you could just write that off. But I've got them upstairs at that very minute saying, go down and show Paul, make your presence known in the basement. The door comes open, which you could say is something making its presence known in the basement. So there's two things that maybe back each other up. The third thing, and this is me getting back to your question about the EVP, later when we listened to the electronic, the audio recorder that Holly had upstairs, not the one that I had in the basement, but that Holly had upstairs, at almost that exact same time, close enough to certainly be like you're hitting a confluence of events here, there's a sound which we play in the episode that sounds like a baby. There's no other way to describe it. It certainly sounded anomalous to me, and again, I'm a skeptic. And so there you have three things happening in very close proximity in different places to each other. To me, that is what makes for an interesting case. And that's true in the UFO field, too. But you have sort of things backing each other up. So if we had just picked up what might have sounded like a baby, I would have gone, well, I don't know, maybe that's just an audio anomaly. What makes it interesting to me is the context and the timing of when we picked it up. You know, me in the basement, that happening, them upstairs claiming to, the psychic claiming about this baby in the basement, which we later found out was actually true. There had been a miscarriage. It's a very long story. And then, you know, you get this audio anomaly of the baby, or at least to me, what later sounded like a baby. So, you know, people can watch that kind of stuff and judge it for themselves, but to me, context is important, the circumstances are important, and so that's what makes a good EVP, as opposed to maybe just sort of sitting there and hearing a strange sound that your audio recorder picked up, but there's no sort of contextual thing about it that makes it interesting.
Well, one of the problems that I have with EVPs, and I don't think that all EVPs are faked. I don't think all of them have an explanation that we know, but some of them do. It's like UFOs. Some UFOs, we may not know what that is, but it may be known, for instance, to someone's Air Force. You
sure.
know, it, and but I've never seen it, so to me it's a UFO. Well, EVPs can be that way, but I think there are some of them that are explainable. And I know, for instance, having been a cop, that when the cop's sitting there running radar, there are three things it takes in order for him to legally be able to write you a traffic citation for speeding. One is he has to see you traveling at a speed that appears to him to be above the speed limit. So he has to have visual contact. Then he looks at his radar, and it has a readout, and it's showing someone traveling at a certain speed, but there's four cars out there coming down the road. Which one is that measuring? There's also an audible. And if there are four cars, there are four tones.
Right.
And the radar is showing you the speed of the biggest vehicle, not necessarily the fastest one, and he's got to pick the tone out that's rising. It's a Doppler effect. And so it takes all three of those things. Well, where I'm headed with this is it picks up stray signals sometimes. From where? Who knows?
Yep.
And it'll register 120 miles an hour, and you look up the road, and there's absolutely no car on the road. You know, it picks up strange signals. Sometimes that's a traffic sign that's vibrating in the wind, and it's picking that up. But sometimes there's no traffic sign, and you don't know where it came from. So an EVP can be caused by some stray electronic signal.
Absolutely.
But it also can be, and I have seen this and heard it, it can be intelligent conversation that answers a question.
Yep. You know what? I don't rule that out. I absolutely agree with you. I actually think most of this EVP stuff is probably explainable in the way that you suggest. However, You'd record hours of audio footage. Would you call it footage? Yeah, sure. Yeah. I'm a filmmaker. I'll call it footage. People know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And you could sift through it. And you could find things that a lot of people, I think, if they had heard them, would have gone, ooh, that's strange, that's weird, that's a voice. I would have listened to it and said, that's clearly an anomaly that is explainable, that's this, that's that, there's no context for this, I dismiss it all. It's only when I would find something that, you know, as I discussed in the McCall's Farm case, had some sort of other context to it. We never actually had a conversation with via EVP, as you're suggesting. Although, I shouldn't say that. You know what? We did have one. Holly was walking out of the basement of an allegedly haunted hotel in the United Kingdom, and she said something along the lines of, I paraphrase here, I can't remember the episode, it was a year and a half ago now, but, you know, hey, ghost, if you're here, contact me, kind of thing. And sure enough, as she was walking up the stairs, because, you know, we can time these things. You have cameras, you know when these
mm-hmm.
things happened.
Right.
There was a sound, and again, it was a small child. And the basement was supposed, people had reported seeing a small child in the basement, a ghostly small child. So she had been down there trying to make contact with it, and nothing really happened. But then as she was walking up the stairs, she said this, and on the audio recorder at that time comes what to me absolutely sounds like a small child. So, you know, in that sense, it's not what I would call a conversation, but you could look at that and you could definitely say that's a response of some
mm-hmm.
sort to somebody looking for something.
I tell you what I saw. I saw a Canadian psychic walking through a house saying that he could see, I don't remember the exact details, we'll say a child.
Sure.
And he starts talking to the child and asking this child questions. And then he tells you what the answer is. Okay? The child says this. Well, they had a recorder going, he had a microphone on that obviously was going to the camera, but they had a recorder going that he was not mic'd to, that was just picking up whatever's in the room. And you hear the EVP give an answer, and then you hear him say, well, the child says this, and it's the same thing. And they line them up so that they're timed exactly the same. It was pretty phenomenal. And he's a pretty phenomenal individual. Anyway, paranormal things, they say, are things for which there is no scientific explanation. Now, that being the case, virtually the entire universe is paranormal. There are all kinds of scientific theories, but there are very few definitive scientific explanations for anything. And, of course, we're learning, and we're learning it more and more, that many of what we thought were laws of science really aren't. We'll be back right after this break. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Paul Kimball, television producer, filmmaker, and all-around interesting guy. Paul, when we went to break, I was saying that, we're learning more and more that a lot of the long-established scientific so-called laws really aren't quite so solid, and they're finding lots of exceptions to them. And or at least they're beginning to find cracks in them. They don't like to talk about it much, but they are there. And that means that there's not actually a scientific explanation for very much in this universe. A lot of theories, a lot of speculation, but no real solid scientific explanation they can nail down and say, this is it. So that would mean then that virtually everything in the universe is paranormal. And I think it really is pretty much a matter of perception. I think that the things, and I want to get your opinion on this, I think the things that we generally call paranormal, such as ghosts, EVPs, things like that, we generally call that paranormal. There's probably some order, if it was studied, really studied scientifically, there's probably some order by which a lot of that operates. And I don't think they would be able to nail it down, but we would find that it's less mysterious. By the same token, a lot of the stuff they tell us they have nailed down, when we really start finding out how they don't have it nailed down, it becomes a bit more mysterious. So on the one hand, things we think we know are a bit more mysterious than we imagine. Things that we think are paranormal are probably a bit less mysterious than we think. What do you think about that?
Sure, absolutely. Let's take Einstein, for instance. I was watching something on YouTube today. It was a video, short video put up by Michio Kaku. Mm-hmm. He does these on a relatively regular basis, one of our foremost theoretical physicists today, mm-hmm. who I've had the pleasure of seeing speak live when I was in London a couple of years ago. And he was talking about Einstein. He was basically saying that modern physics has proved that free will exists, that we don't live in a sort of Calvinistic, predeterministic universe where God orders everything and sets it all down and everything is predetermined to happen in a certain way. And he goes, which is what Einstein believed, which was, it's what he believed physics showed. He said, and there's, so Michio Kaku goes, Einstein was wrong. And here's why. And I think he went on to talk about the Heisenberg principle and other things. And you know what? There you have one physicist, the greatest physicist perhaps, or at least one of the greatest physicists of our time, saying that the greatest physicist of his time, and I think most people would probably look on Einstein, you could go almost anywhere in the world, I think, and most people would at least know the name, mm-hmm. saying that he was wrong on a crucially fundamental element of physics. So, and I imagine that someday, 40 or 50 years from now, somebody is going to say Michio Kaku was wrong about this or that. And that's part of knowledge. So that doesn't mean that science, quote, quote, whatever science is inherently wrong in and of itself. It just means that our understanding of the universe around us, our understanding of ourselves, is consistently growing. So 2,000 years ago, leading scientific thought, you know, if they had newspapers or CNN, newsflash, scientists confirm Earth flat. You know, and that would have been the scientific consensus. Newsflash, 1,500 years ago, or even 500 years ago, scientists confirm Earth center of universe. Sun revolves around Earth. That was the scientific consensus. Eventually, new people come along with new ways of thinking, and they discovered, no, actually, the Earth revolves around the sun. No, the Earth actually is not flat, it is round. And so those things that were once consensus become proven to be wrong, and science says, no, here's the new consensus, and we can actually prove that this is right. And there, and then you establish it as a fact. Fine. But the important thing about science is not necessarily the conclusions any particular scientist or even body of scientists come to. The important thing about science is the scientific method, how you go about studying things that are unknown, even how you go about studying things that you think are known. And the constant need to reassess, to reinterpret, to look at it in new ways when new information becomes available. But there is a method to science, and that is what people should take away from it. So when people tell me science says this or science says that, I go, well, I don't really care, because science has said, quote, quote, scientists have said a lot of things over the years that have been proven to be wrong. What I care about is, and what I think we can all take from science, is the methodology that they employ, that scientists employ, that we should all employ when confronting things that are unknown, when looking for answers to questions. And that requires evidence. It requires you to keep an open, skeptical mind about things. It requires, frankly, repeatability, which is a major problem within the UFO phenomenon, at least as far as scientists, when they look at it, are concerned. You know, there's a whole number of things that are required to employ the scientific method. But that is the important thing about science, the method that they use to study these things, to come up with conclusions, and then to reassess and reevaluate those conclusions, and the willingness to do it when you get new information.
I had, a couple of years ago, I had Michio Kaku as a guest on this show. And he was promoting his new book, at that time, new book called Physics of the Impossible. And a couple of times he mentioned laws of physics, and I said, Dr. Kaku, isn't it true that there really are no laws of physics? What we're calling laws of physics are just descriptions of our current understanding of how things work. And someday, some real smart person's going to come along, like Einstein did, and step right over one or more of those so-called laws of physics with a whole new understanding that makes better sense. And he said, absolutely. And you've just described it very well. And that is, you know, what people think are scientific facts set in stone, really, it's just a description of some observations. They may or may not be correct. Time will tell. And science, it really is more of a journey than a destination, or it should be. Should be a journey of continual discovery and reevaluation. And I agree with everything you just said.
Yeah, absolutely. Science, I would only rephrase what you said slightly. I would say science, the journey is not science. The journey is discovery and knowledge. Science is the vehicle.
Oh, well, I can buy that.
It's like taking a car on the highway. Science is the way you get to those things. And so it's kind of like the Prius that you drive to get from Los Angeles to Vegas or whatever. But, you know, the destination is knowledge and learning. And science is just the way that you get there. And frankly, you know what? Science, I think it's a wonderful way to get there. But I think there are other ways that you can obtain knowledge too, obviously. And so some of these things that we're talking about, particularly, say, ghosts, might not be amenable to true scientific investigation. You see people wandering around with EMF meters, and none of them know what they really do or how they really work, frankly, as far as I'm concerned. There's a very, you know, there might be, I think there is, a sort of spiritual, existential element to a lot of this paranormal stuff that science maybe is not well equipped to address. And as a lot of scientists will tell you, you know, we handle what's happening, and religion or spirituality or individuals handle why. And a lot of these things are why questions, not what questions.
You're right. We have to step away for break, and when we come back, we're going to get into UFOs. And believe it or not, there's actually a link. And we've been talking about it, and we'll talk about it some more. But we're going to, when we come back, get into some of these UFO films Paul Kimball has done. We'll be back right after this. You're listening to The Kevin Smith Show, and welcome to those of you who are joining us just now in this second hour. My sincere sympathy to you for whatever it is that kept you away from that first hour. My guest this evening, Paul Kimball. He is a television producer, and he is a filmmaker and known to our audience, although he does not exclusively make films about UFOs or about the paranormal. He would be best known in our audience as a result of the films in that genre that he has made. And I want to talk about some of those. In fact, we've been talking about the paranormal television series that you did. But I want to talk about this UFO thing. You Paul produced a film called Best Evidence, Top 10 UFO Sightings. And that came out a couple of years ago. By the way, folks, he's posted it on his company website. If you want to watch it, you can watch it for free. And all you have to do is click on his picture on my website. It'll take you there. But, Paul, go ahead and tell us what the web address is.
Sure. Thanks, Kevin. It's www.redstarfilmtv.com. And if you Google my name or Red Star Films, you'll probably run into it as well. So it has a lot of our old productions available for free now on the Internet through our distributors and stuff. They put them up on YouTube and various places. And it also has information on upcoming projects and things that we're working on going forward.
Red Star Films. Now, we talked about sports a little bit at the beginning. Did you know that Red Star is the name of the football team, the soccer team, from Belgrade, Serbia?
I certainly did. When I was younger, it was Red Star Belgrade, you know, when it was still Yugoslavia.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember it well. I've actually been, I guess, accused by some people who, within the paranormal field, there's always people who are trying to find a way to bring you down or whatever. And there was actually one guy who went out of his way to say I was a communist because my company was called Red Star Films. And I said, well, you know, I'm not going to get into which way I lean politically, but that has absolutely nothing to do with it, sir. So, you know, fill your boots, but that's not what it's about.
Yeah, I've got one guy that he tries to hit me on the Internet everywhere he can, and he sends me email telling me, and then I've got two or three people that have said this, but this guy is really vicious about it, that because my show's logo uses a font that looks very similar to the band Kiss. You know, when you see Kiss and you see it written up there on the stage behind them, you know how it's what it looks like?
Yep.
Well, my fonts that I use are not exactly the same, but they look very similar to that. And he goes out there and tells people that I've got Hitler's SS up there and all this nonsense. And I responded to him in one place, and I said, are you nuts? I said, it's very similar to the band Kiss, and the two founders of that are Jewish. You really think this is a Hitler thing?
Yeah.
Nuts. Just nuts.
There are a number of those people out there, and I've had a long-running debate with a lot of friends of mine within the filmmaking community, but also the paranormal community, if you will, the people I consider credible and serious, about anonymity on the Internet. And usually these people, when they come and they attack you, and it happens in politics and music and film, it happens everywhere,
mm-hmm.
you know, they hide behind a cloak of anonymity. So I, generally speaking, don't take their comments terribly seriously, especially when they would do something like that to you or accuse me of being a communist because my company's name is Red Star, for Pete's sake.
Yeah.
It's all a bit ridiculous.
Okay, let's talk about Best Evidence.
Sure.
Now, this is really a clever idea. You asked some of the top names in the field of UFO investigations to submit to you a list of what they thought were the 10 best UFO sightings. And then you distilled that. You obviously got a whole bunch more than 10 because each of them would give you a list of 10. They wouldn't all be the same. But you've distilled that down into the 10 best UFO sightings out of this group. How did you do that? By what process were you able to distill this into 10 best UFO sightings?
Sure. The one thing that I would like to make clear off the bat, Kevin, my old friend, the late Dick Hall, who was one of the great UFO researchers of all time, started with NICAP in the 1960s, I believe, wrote the UFO Evidence Volume 1 and 2, just a tremendous UFO researcher. He's in the film. I interviewed him before he passed away 2 years ago. I asked him for a list, and Dick said he wouldn't give me a top 10 list because he couldn't, every day it would change. There's so many good cases. So what he called it was, I'm going to give you a 10 of the best cases, but not necessarily the 10 best, because if I asked him tomorrow, he might have a different 10. So I kind of called, even though it says top 10 UFO sightings, I kind of say, look, folks, this is the tip of the iceberg. These are 10 of the best, but there are, we had a total of, I think, 75 cases when I picked all the cases. You'd obviously get a lot of cases that everybody would kind of pick, but there were a lot of other cases that maybe only one or two people would pick, so they wouldn't make the film, but they were still very good cases. So what we would do is, if I had asked you, for instance, I would say, Kevin, give me your list of 10 of the best cases, if you will. You would say, well, okay, number one was this, number two was this, on down through number 10. I would get that along with everybody else's. I assigned a point value to each choice. So whatever case you picked is number 10, I would give 10 points. Whatever case you picked is number 2, I would give 9, and so on down. Until the 10th case that you picked would get 1 point. At the end of the day, it was pretty simple. I'd take all of the cases that everybody had picked and all the points that they had been assigned. I'd add them up, and whatever case got the most points, great, you're number one. Whatever case got the second most points after it's all added up, you're number two, and so forth. So that's how we came up with the list of the 10 best cases, or as I've since admitted, I admitted at the time too, the 9 best cases. Because I kicked the 10th best case out, I exercised my editorial discretion. It is my film, after all. And I put in a case from 1561, the Nuremberg carving case, because I wanted to make the point that the UFO phenomenon, it's a point that's been made by Jacques Vallée and a number of people over the years, the UFO phenomenon existed prior to 1947. Everybody thinks it started in 1947 with Kenneth Arnold, but the truth is, strange things were being seen in the skies by human beings well before, for hundreds and thousands of years before that. And I wanted to make that point, so I removed the 10th case, and I stuck the Nuremberg case in at number 10. So it's really top 9 UFO sightings plus 1 picked by Paul, because I wanted to make a point. But I think it's an important point, so I don't apologize for it, but I do let people know that I did that.
All right, now I'm going to ask you probably an impossible question.
Uh-oh.
You made the film, so you obviously are well aware of the content of each of those cases. Out of the 10, which one to you was the most spectacular?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's one I've been asked a number of times. And in different ways, but it always kind of comes down to the same thing. What do I think was the best case? Mm-hmm. I picked two. The case that came in at number one, the RB-47 case from 1957, has always been my personal favorite. I think in terms of evidence, in terms of everything that happened within that case, it remains the best unsolved UFO case in history. And it was so far ahead of every other case in our poll that, you know, the majority of UFO researchers seem to agree with me. The other case that I really like is the case that came in at number 5, which very few people, I would say almost nobody outside the sort of UFO research community, had ever heard of prior to my film. And even most people, I think, within sort of ufology had never really heard of, because it wasn't a very well-known case, except to some UFO researchers. Was a case that happened in 1953 off the coast of California, just north of Los Angeles, in a Santa Barbara channel. And what happened in that case, and I think the RB-47 case is more well known. We can come back to that later if you want, but the Santa Barbara channel case is one I really like because of the quality of witnesses. What you have is, on the ground in Agoura, California, you had Kelly Johnson and his wife. They lived in Agoura. Now, for folks who don't know who Kelly Johnson was, the best way to put it is he's the man who basically designed the U-2 spy plane. He was one of the top aerodynamicists, aeronautical engineers of the 20th century. The term genius gets tossed around far too often, but Kelly Johnson was a genius in terms of designing aircraft. And he was building the most advanced, secretive aircraft known to mankind at that time, including the U-2 spy plane. So he was working for Lockheed out in California at that time, and that's what he was doing. So that, if he had just seen something on his own, that would be an interesting case in and of itself, because you have a pretty good witness who knows what's flying in the sky, and that would be interesting. Not a great case, but still a good one. So what happens is he stands on the porch of his house. He looks out over the land to see Santa Barbara Channel, and he sees an object up in the sky over the channel. So he goes and he gets his binoculars, his wife sees it too, and he observes it with his binoculars, and he describes as best he can, because he's, you know, fairly far away, obviously, but looking through the binoculars, he describes it as best he can later when he made a report. I'll get to that in a second. Meanwhile, unbeknownst to him, flying across the ocean over Santa Barbara Channel was a crew from Lockheed of some of his best test pilots, aerodynamicists, aeronautical engineers, names that won't mean anything to people, but these were the best of the best, guys like Rudy Thorne, Roy Wimmer, Philip Coleman. These were top people in that field at that time. There was nobody better. So they're flying across at the same time, unbeknownst to him, in this plane, and they see the exact same thing from an even closer and better vantage point than Kelly Johnson does. So we've got Johnson seeing this and describing it in certain ways, but his description is fairly amorphous because he can't see detail as well. He's further away. So he describes sort of a kind of blob in the sky, and then he says it disappeared quickly because it moved at a high rate of speed, but it kind of hovered and then it disappeared. Well, the guys on the plane had a better view. And so what they described in their reports, one fellow in particular described it as a flying wing-shaped object, and they described it moving at an extremely high rate of speed. One guy said as we approached it, it disappeared in about 10 seconds, which is a rate of speed that no aircraft at that time could make. I'm not sure any aircraft at our time today could make that rate of speed the way they were describing it. So this is a tremendously interesting case for a couple of reasons. And I probably haven't done it justice the way I've just described it. The quality of witnesses, the reports, by the way, are all available online. They were reported to Project Blue Book. If you go to a website called the Project Blue Book Archive, all of Project Blue Book files are up there. That's where this case was found. It was sort of buried and forgotten in the Project Blue Book files until researchers went, and as they were going through it, they went, holy cow, this is a really good case, and tracked down some of the surviving witnesses. So you've got tremendous quality witnesses. These are people who knew what was flying in the skies because they were building and flying them. You have two sets of independent witnesses, Johnson and his wife on the ground, and then the crew in the plane, both observing the same object at the same time and describing, generally speaking, the same characteristics. The crew in the plane being at a better vantage point, having a better look, their descriptions are I would take as more accurate. So you have multiple witnesses confirming each other, top-notch quality witnesses, and then the kicker is when they show up the next day at work, they go, hey, you know, kind of, I paraphrase, hey, guess what happened to us yesterday? We saw this. And Kelly Johnson would go, really? Because I saw this. And then they realized they were looking at the same thing. So the Air Force asked them to write formal reports, which they did. The reports are fairly detailed in terms of what they considered to be the speed of the object that they saw, the height that it was at, all that sort of stuff. And the Air Force's explanation, I always call this the cherry on the cake, because it's a pretty good cake. The Air Force comes back to them and they say, what you saw was a lenticular cloud. Now, people have mistaken lenticular clouds for UFOs in the past. There's no question. However, these guys are not guys who were going to be mistaking lenticular clouds for a UFO, a structured craft, especially when, in their reports, they specifically, as any good witness, as any good scientist would, considered, hey, did we see a lenticular cloud? Maybe that was it. And they said no. So it's not like this was a surprise to them. They had already considered this possibility and ruled it out because they said what we saw bore absolutely no, you know, remote description to a lenticular cloud. So you have a patently ridiculous United States Air Force explanation, which is always fun, as the topper of the case. I think that's a tremendous case. I think that and the RB-47 case and the other cases in my film are the kinds of cases that UFO researchers should be talking about when they speak in public. And unfortunately, they're not the kinds of cases that they talk about. They tend to prefer to talk about Roswell and the sort of sexy crashed alien flying saucer cases. And the truth is, neither the disbelievers nor the believers want to talk about cases like the Santa Barbara Channel case or the RB-47 case because there's no easy answers. You're left with more questions at the end of the day than you are with answers. But I think that's the inherent essence of the UFO phenomenon, is that it's still a mystery. And those are the kind of cases that we should be putting forward to the public and saying, look, this is not only mysterious. This is interesting and fascinating, and we should all be interested in this because it's fun. It, you know, there's a gee whiz factor to it. What did these guys see? How do you explain it? Why are we not asking more questions about this? How can you not be interested in a case like that? But that's not what people are talking about, and I've never quite understood that, but there you go.
Well, you know, it's also true that Project Blue Book, a lot of people look at Project Blue Book and they say, okay, Project Blue Book was a whitewash, and it was just there so that they could explain away everything. That may have been their intention. I don't know. Being as I'm not God, I don't know what their intentions were. But they did explain away almost all the cases. However, they had literally thousands and thousands of cases that were reported to them. There were something over 1,400 cases that they still had to list as unknown. They couldn't explain them at all, and they listed them as unknown. And they had a corporation by the name of, I think it was Battelle.
Yes.
That did a computer analysis of all of the responses, and what they found, among many surprising things they found, the more detail and the better the professional quality of the witness, in terms of, for instance, a pilot or an airplane designer, the better the quality of the witness, the better the detail, the more likely it was going to be in that group of unknowns. And so, far from saying, and this is the way the debunkifiers usually do this, they'll say, well, Project Blue Book, you know, they studied it for years and years and years, and they concluded there was really nothing to it. It could be explained by natural phenomena or misidentified aircraft and blah, 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 blah. That isn't true. Project Blue Book is an official U.S. government document that admits there are UFOs.
Sure. And I've sat on a panel before at a UFO conference when a number of the speakers were talking about disclosure. The big word was, we need the U.S. government to disclose the truth about UFOs. And by truth, they meant that aliens have visited Earth and interacted with us and all of that. And I made the heretical comment, which actually got me booed by a number of people. I said, there's already been disclosure in the United States, folks. They were the Project Blue Book files. They were released 30 years ago to the public. It was a disclosure of information. A lot of those investigations were competently done. The Santa Barbara Channel case is a great example. All the reports are there in the Blue Book files. All anybody had to do is look. The disclosure of UFO information is there. Here's the thing. What it discloses is the United States government, at the end of the day, doesn't know what's going on any more than we do. So when you look at these unexplained cases, the disclosure is we don't know. But that's not what people want to hear. People want to hear that, yes, the government does know, and they're keeping that secret from us. And that's where I part ways with the believers, as I call them, and frankly, the disbelievers, too, because they argue in that same sort of meme. And I'm much more interested in looking at the unknown cases, because I still think it's a mystery, and it remains, you know, an interesting question that we don't have an explanation for yet.
Well, see, disclosure then has two strikes against it. Disclosure being defined as you described it, and I think most people would describe it that way, where a government spokesman or a panel goes in front of cameras and they start talking about what the government knows about UFOs. There are two strikes against that, at least. Now, one strike would be if they do know. If they do know, they can't go in front of the cameras and start telling us, because they would have to admit to years of lies and crimes. If they don't know, they're not going to go in front of the cameras and tell us we don't know, because they think that will shake our confidence in our government as if there was much.
It is a bit of a conundrum, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, you know, there's no easy way about it. The one thing that I've consistently said is, if there is a government conspiracy that is withholding the truth about aliens on Earth. The last people who are ever going to uncover it are a plucky little group of UFO researchers waving about freedom of information applications. You know, if they've been able to keep such a secret for 60, 65 years, I'm fairly confident that the exopolitics or disclosure movement or whomever is not going to be able to shake it loose today or tomorrow.
Well, no. I don't think there's going to be a golden moment. But, you know, if water drips on granite long enough, it will erode granite. And it just may take a whole lot longer than people suspect. But I'll tell you something. I've also said this, Paul. All of that government secrecy about UFOs came about as a result of an executive order signed by a president. It started with Truman. All it takes to end that secrecy is an executive order that ends it. And there is proof of this, that it does work. Down in Ecuador, there was a guy that ran for president and said, I will make the UFO files public. Got elected. They held his feet to the fire. The electorate did and said, you promised, so let's have it. He gave the order, and the order was given to the Air Force and to the Army that you will no longer classify information about UFOs as secret, and you will begin releasing the information. They didn't do it. And they didn't do it because they were getting perks from the U.S. government to keep it quiet. They were being paid by the U.S. government to keep it quiet. At least that's the testimony of the Ecuadorian government. So the Ecuadorian president fired all the top generals, put the order in writing, put new people in their place, and today it's completely open.
I think it's reasonably completely open in the United States, too. That's usually where I disagree with most UFO researchers.
Do you really?
Are there still secrets that are kept? Is there still information that has not been released? I have no doubt that there are cases and information that hasn't been released. But I don't think that represents an overarching conspiracy to hide the truth of that the government knows that aliens have visited Earth. I think the truth is the government doesn't know. I think most cases have been released, as they have in the United Kingdom and Canada. I think they were in the United States, too. And the Tehran case in 1976 in our film is a perfectly good example of a case that came about after Project Blue Book was closed down, after the Condon report in the late 60s. The U.S. government was still investigating it, but we know about it now. We know the details now because they were later released. So that information is out there. It just doesn't give a lot of UFO believers the answer, alien extraterrestrial believers the answer that they want.
So you would not subscribe to, well, you know what? We've got a break coming up. I'll go ahead and ask the question. You can think about your answer, and we'll let you answer it on the other side of the break. Based on what you're saying, I would take it that you don't think that the U.S. military has ever recovered any alien bodies or live aliens from any crashes. And I would take it then that you would also necessarily not think that they have these aliens stored away somewhere in a secret location, and that they're hiding that from the public. Now, when we get back from break, I'm going to give you the chance to answer that question. We'll be back right after this. On the radio feed, for some reason, the music just wouldn't start and then finally started. We'll get that fixed. Sorry to our affiliates about that, but Just a weird little quirk. We'll find out what the problem is with that file. All right, now before we went to break, I asked you, Paul Kimball, based on what you have described for us, I would take it that you think that the U.S. government has not recovered any aliens, dead or alive, and do not have them tucked away somewhere.
Yes, I would agree with that. That's my position. There's no firm proof that shows that. There's a lot of speculation and conspiracy theorizing, and I think people find it fascinating and interesting, and as I've often said, I think it's sexy, for lack of a better word. You know, it's, you know, aliens and stuff. It gives them the answers that they want. And I think people like to believe in conspiracies, too. There is an anti-government stream running through Western society, particularly in the United States, but also in Canada and other countries. I think all of those things are at play there. But to me, it comes down to evidence, and it just comes down to plausibility, too. The one question that I always ask people, for instance, when they're talking about the Roswell case, I say, well, okay, let's just assume that you're right. Let's assume that aliens traveled here from a distant civilization, and I use distant to apply to even the next star over. And I don't think people actually have an understanding of just how far away we're talking about and how difficult it would be to get here, even from the nearest star system. So you hear people, my uncle Stan Friedman is one of those people, who talks about the local galactic neighborhood, the cosmic neighborhood, and it makes it sound as if, you know what, it's like walking down the block to the corner store to pick up a loaf of bread. And so it makes people think, well, maybe, you know, it's not really that hard. The truth is, it's incredibly hard. We still haven't sent a spacecraft out of our own solar system. We're at the fringes of the solar system now with the Voyager probe. But beyond that is an immense distance that our minds can't even fathom to the next star.
Yeah, but here's a fallacy. Here's a fallacy in that reasoning. You're talking about us, our technology, and our way of thinking. When you're talking about extraterrestrials, provided they exist and are intelligent, and provided they are thousands, perhaps millions of years ahead of us, technologically, what we think is very, very difficult, they would think of as a snap of their fingers. And here's an example right here from Earth. If you go back 100 years, just 100 years, that's not far. That's not even a spit in the wind of history. 100 years. Talk to those people and ask them, is it possible for you to leave, say, Los Angeles today and have dinner this evening in Beijing, China? They would laugh at you. Impossible. It's done every day now.
Sure. And I have no argument about that. I've made that point to disbelievers, if you will, any number of times when I say, look, space travel may, in fact, and it is possible, we do it. It certainly may be possible to travel between the stars. I believe it is for an advanced civilization. And you can sit down or listen to Michio Kaku talk, and he will explain, though, that there are basically four types of civilizations. Type 0, which is where we are, Type 1, Type 2, and Type 3. And the amount of time it would take to get from a Type 0 civilization just to a Type 1 civilization, which is travel within your own solar system, as I recall, Type 2 is travel within, you know, beyond your own solar system, is a tremendous leap. You're talking hundreds and thousands of years. So mm-hmm. The point that I was trying to make is, let's assume that the aliens actually have figured it out. I'll grant you that. So they can travel between the stars. So I think if you're going to assume that, you have to assume that they're hundreds or thousands of years in advance of us technologically. As Arthur C. Clarke would say, their technology might almost seem to us like magic.
Yeah.
But here's what we get whenever we hear reports of these crashed flying saucers. We get reports of crashed flying saucers, of craft that seem remarkably similar to the kind of craft that we're flying, the nuts and bolts kind of things, for instance. Beings that look in many respects remarkably similar to us and behave remarkably similar to us. And then the most common explanation that people seem to offer for why these advanced spacecraft that can make it all the way across the reaches of space from there to here, even if they are just excursion modules coming down from a mothership, somehow they can be brought down by radar beams or something on the planet Earth. I find that virtually impossible to believe, but the kicker for me is, even if it did crash, even if I accept all of that and I accept that the spacecraft crashed at Roswell for whatever reason, what I find it impossible to accept is that the aliens would just leave it there for us to find, that it was sitting out in the desert. These are beings that, to get here, would have to have, as you described, this incredibly advanced technology. Even if I accept that, I also have to accept that if they have that incredibly advanced technology, they could certainly, you know, sort of stop by and recover the crashed spacecraft before we find it. So the implausibility of spacecraft that seem maybe 50 or 100 years in advance to us appear in ways, look to us like the kind of craft that maybe we could design, don't behave all that much differently than us, and can be brought down by radar beams or whatever might have brought them down, and then are not bothered, you know, not picked up. That's a narrative that's straight out of 1950s science fiction. And that's, to me, that's where it comes from, because that's where the original crash flying saucer story, the Aztec hoax, came from. It was rooted in the science fiction and the Cold War paranoia of the late 40s and through the 1950s.
Now I'm going to play the devil's advocate. Okay?
Sure.
Have you ever heard of the supersonic transport?
Yes.
They called it the Concorde. Most advanced aircraft ever built and used for commercial air travel. And the thing that ended, it was the straw that broke the camel's back. The thing that ended the supersonic transport, and it no longer flies, was a piece, a little short piece of angle iron laying on a runway that shredded a tire on takeoff. Very non-technological, bringing down the most high technology aircraft being used, ever used, for commercial air flight. And there was massive destruction, people dying, and it was non-technology. A Ferrari is high technology automobile, and it will outrun just about any police car on the planet, but it cannot outrun the, they go by different names, pop strips. It's the spikes that are deployed on strips, and the cops get out ahead of where this is going. If they're you got a cop chasing a Ferrari, they get out ahead of it, throw these out on the street, and when the Ferrari runs over it, low technology brings down high technology. As for why they would leave their craft there after a crash, we do. The United States of America has some stealth bombers and stealth fighters. They don't get brought down often, but they have been brought down, and we leave them where they lay. And that technology then is in the hands of the people who brought it down, the pieces of it. So just because a civilization may be hundreds of thousands of years ahead of us in technology doesn't mean they are that different from us. Their toys are different. You know, we're not all that different from people of, say, 1850. We're pretty much the same as the people in 1850, but our toys are really different.
Sure, we're the same species as them too, though. We're talking about, and I'll play the devil's advocate now, what you've done is, and this is what's done within ufology when they talk about these things, is reduce an incredibly complex scenario, aliens traveling here from an extraterrestrial civilization somewhere else in our galaxy, mm-hmm. even within our local cosmic neighborhood, and the technology that would require, and they reduce it down to talking in terms that we find it comfortable and easy to understand. Oh, well, it's like the Concorde, or it's like going to the corner store to get bread, or it's like a Maserati can be brought down by spikes. I much prefer the analysis that somebody like Michio Kaku will give. And I've read his books. I saw him speak. And I think he's dead on. He talks about a galactic conversation. He says, yes, there are extraterrestrial civilizations out there. It would be foolish to think otherwise. Yes, there are almost certainly ones out there that are far more advanced than us. And they are having a conversation. They might even be traveling between the stars. And I asked him when I was in London. I went to see him speak. And I said, Dr. because they had a Q&A afterwards. I said, Dr. Kaku, you've written about a galactic conversation. My question would be, when do you think we might be able to tune in to that galactic conversation? And his, and I think he's dead on. His answer to me was, we are nowhere near it. We're thousands of years away from tuning into it. It is. He used the ant analogy. They are like human beings to ants. We, and by the way, as he said, he kind of laughed. He said, in case anyone's wondering, we're the ants. So the conversation could be happening on all around us. He said, we wouldn't even recognize it as it was happening, as a conversation. And I think that's what makes the UFO phenomenon. Frankly, the stories of crash flying saucers and stuff, to me, that's bad science fiction, and it's not interesting. What's truly interesting is, you know, the possibility that there is a truly advanced civilization out there that might even be coming here, a non-human intelligence. It might occasionally even interact with us. But in ways that I don't think ufology and UFO research is equipped to answer and hasn't been looking in the right sort of places. And it would appear to us, at least to me, and I think Kaku and others probably agree with this, it would appear in a way that would be totally unlike anything that we would expect it to look like, using the UFO meme where they're basically, they travel and look a lot like us, the science fiction meme, as I call it. I throw out the science fiction, and I'm much more interested in talking about what I think is the science fact. And that, to me, is a much more mysterious and a much more interesting possibility than crash-flying saucers who've come to bring the Space Brothers to us, who are going to solve all our problems. And anybody who's familiar with the contactee movement within ufology, which today has been replaced by the disclosure movement, that's essentially the narrative they tell of these advanced beings that are here to solve all of humanity's problems, or they're here to, you know, sort of create hybrids and rule us. Either or, depending on whether you view them as good or bad. I view them as much more interesting than stock science fiction characters from a 1950s science fiction movie.
And okay, well, like let me play the devil's advocate on one more point.
Sure.
In telling us about which case you thought was most interesting, you gave us two, and the one you talked about was the one where you have the, I believe his name was Robert Kelly, the designer of advanced aircraft, super secret aircraft. So you have his testimony. You have the testimony of some test pilots that are in an airplane coming across the bay. So you accept the testimony of these guys as to what they saw and when they saw it and what its capabilities appeared to be. Why would you not accept testimony of people who say that they have seen in the possession of the U.S. military extraterrestrial beings?
Because I have never heard anybody make that claim who I consider to be credible. I'm happy to hear somebody sort of tell me who that person would be. There's no question that Kelly Johnson, Rudy Thorne, Roy Wimmer, Philip Coleman, all those people in that particular case were credible witnesses who, at the end of the day, said, we don't know what we saw. We just saw something that's anomalous and unexplained. They weren't making a claim that it was extraterrestrial or anything like that. They just said it's a genuine UFO of interest. I have never heard anybody who has come forward who says that they have seen a dead alien, or a live one for that matter, who has been able to back up their claim, who has been able to provide solid evidence for that claim. And that,
well, they couldn't provide solid evidence for their claim. It was their testimony.
Sorry, pardon, I didn't hear that part, Kevin.
Yeah, the guys that we were talking about from Lockheed, they didn't provide any solid evidence. They provided their testimony.
Sure, but that their testimony is corroborating witnesses, so it's not one person, or it's not even three people standing in the same place cooking up a story. It's two independent groups of witnesses coming together and telling the same story. Any lawyer, police officer, or judge will tell you that is
We have to step away for break. We'll pick up there when we come back. Don't go away, folks. More from my guest, Paul Kimball. Again, for those on listening on radio or listening to the computer, it did it again. I guess it's a software problem. We'll get it fixed by tomorrow. Worked fine yesterday. My guest is Paul Kimball, and Paul, we're on the final approach. Let me just ask you this. Would you take the testimony of a Harvard psychiatrist who was one of the most respected psychiatrists in the country in his lifetime, who interviewed hundreds of people who claimed that they had been abducted by extraterrestrials and had come to the conclusion that, number one, they weren't crazy. Number two, they had truly experienced something phenomenal. And number three, they truly believed they were telling him the truth, and he came to the conclusion that they were telling him the truth and that extraterrestrial abductions were taking place. Would that be good evidence for you?
I presume you're speaking about the late Dr. John Mack.
Yeah.
You could equally say an eminent Harvard psychiatrist, Dr. Susan Clancy, wrote a book wherein she complete, this is the thing about science, like we were talking about earlier,
mm-hmm.
the idea of finding a scientific consensus.
I know where you're headed with Susan Clancy. Go ahead. I'm going to blow her bathtub up, but go ahead.
I'm not saying that Dr. Clancy is right or wrong. I think the explanations that she offered in her book explain a number of so-called alien abduction cases, not all of them, but a number of cases. I would point to the work of Kevin Randall, who is a believer in the extraterrestrial hypothesis. He actually one of the world's foremost Roswell advocates, for instance.
Yeah.
But Kevin Randall has written a book called The Abduction Enigma, where he literally flat out says there's nothing to the alien abduction phenomenon. Now, I don't go that far. I think most so-called alien abduction cases can be explained. That's a whole show into unto itself. And the work.
Well, I think that's true, just as most UFO cases can be explained. As not being actually UFOs, most of them can. But, you know, how many elephants does it take to prove that elephants exist? One.
Well, it's a good question, and it's, you know, it's a nice line. It's the kind of line I would use, frankly. It's good stuff. But the problem is you have these abduction researchers, and I put the term researchers in quotation marks, I think creating this idea that it's aliens doing the abduction. So this meme, this idea has been created by them. It's a very long story. I think you can see it now. The work of leading abduction researchers David Jacobs and Bud Hopkins is coming under increasing questioning, even within ufology. So think about that for a second. Even within ufology, it's coming under question now. And some of their practices are being revealed as questionable at best. So, but does that mean that there's nothing to the abduction phenomenon? No. These people have done a grave disservice to the search for truth about what might be a genuinely anomalous and mysterious phenomenon by force-fitting it into this alien abduction idea. And I think the same thing, Kevin, has been done with the UFO phenomenon in general. People come saying, here is the answer. And this is, you know, we're doing a new film, Beyond Best Evidence, where we want to go beyond these cases and do something that nobody's done really yet, which is make a film that talks about the possible explanations for UFOs. And not just the extraterrestrial hypothesis. That's one of them, and we're going to talk about that with Stan Friedman and Kevin Randall. They're on board. But we're also going to talk about the extra-dimensional hypothesis that people like Phil Imbrogno and Jacques Vallée have talked about, and the idea of time travel, and the idea that maybe it is really all explainable. in terrestrial prosaic terms. So we want to cover all the bases, because I think that's what somebody who's really looking for the truth to a mystery is going to do, look at all the possible explanations and not just focus in on one.
Well, and I think that's a good approach. However, I would say that if it's interdimensional, they're coming from another dimension to here, if they're coming through time to here, it's still extraterrestrial. They're not here and now. But it may not, you know, I have said many, many times that the idea that aliens get in a spacecraft and fly linear directions through space at excess of the speed of light, what that does is it tells you that the person who thinks that is bound to Einstein's theory of the universe. And that's a problem. Einstein was smart, but even Einstein says, I don't have it figured out yet. So, I don't think they fly at excess of the speed of light along a line that brings them here. I don't think that's the way the technology works at all. But wherever they come from, if they're not from this planet, and they're not from here and now, that's extraterrestrial.
True enough, but I think when people talk about the extraterrestrial hypothesis or aliens or answers, it has a very specific meaning within our culture, which is that they are not coming from another dimension, they're not coming from another time. They are aliens from another planet in our time, in our galaxy, and they're traveling here in nuts and bolts spacecraft. And so I think when anybody within UFO research uses the term the extraterrestrial hypothesis, that's what they're talking about. So,
well, they need to get a dictionary and get educated then.
Huh?
Then they need to get a dictionary and get educated. Extra means apart from. Terrestrial comes from the Latin word terra, which is the Latin name for this planet, apart from this planet. That's all it means.
And I don't disagree with you, but that's not the conversation that people... that's not the way that it's framed in popular culture, and that's you know, kind of the world that we have to work in. So we have to give them other terms like extra-dimensional. And, which one is it? I don't know. That's the question that we're still asking when we look at these cases, I think.
Well, I suppose if you're dealing with two-year-olds, you have to speak their language. But I don't think there's anything wrong with them being told to go get a dictionary. And sure. I'm not trying to be harsh. I'm just trying to be real. Yeah. You know, I think we have to have grown-up concepts and grown-up conversations. Extra-dimensional means apart from this dimension. They're not from this dimension. Extraterrestrial means they're not from this planet. And they may look exactly like us. It may be that they are humans, but they're from some other time, some other place, some other dimension. But they're just not from here, and they're not from now.
I absolutely agree with you, Kevin. I think, you know, the key is that we need to have an adult, serious conversation about a serious subject, serious issues. I just don't think that conversation's being had. I don't think it's been had for a very long time.
Oh, I agree with you.
I think the start of the conversation is for everybody to stand back and say, we don't have the answer yet, and to be very wary of somebody who says that they do.
I could not agree more. I could not agree more. I don't think we have the answer for much of anything, really. And most particularly on this subject of UFOs and the subject of extraterrestrials.
Being a good Canadian, I always like to end on a high note of agreeing. So that building consensus is what we do up here in the North. So that's always good to end on a high note of agreeing on something.
Well, I'll tell you, when you hear me play the devil's advocate, you have no idea what I believe, because I don't believe anything.
I'm more or less the same way. my motto on my website is, and it has been for years, don't believe, don't disbelieve, think.
That's it.
And that's the only way I think you can look at it.
And little by little, we get to a point where we can say, I know. But until we can say, I know, it's okay to say, I don't know. And to be comfortable with that. Paul, we're out of time. I want to thank you for being with us this evening. And if you will, just stay on the telephone with me for a moment as I bring this in for a landing. Ladies and gentlemen, Paul Kimball, check it out, Red Star Films. You just click on his picture on my website, and it'll take you over there. And he's got a whole bunch of films and film clips that you can watch. Particularly, you want to watch Best Evidence, Top 10 UFO Sightings. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.